fighter. If you've got to fight, fight dirty.
Damn, look like my women is on time.
Babe, I could so warm you up.
No shit, baby.
I can dig it.
They called her One Eye, then ran for their lives. We've got a peck of trouble.
This is Larry Cohen speaking, and you're listening to the Daily Grindhouse Podcast.
Here we go.
Bastards, welcome back to the Daily Grindhouse Podcast, episode number 5. We were really tempted to call this John Carpenter's Daily Grindhouse Podcast, but we thought there could be potentially some ownership issues with that. So instead, we're going with the far less impressive John Carpenter, the Daily Grindhouse interview. So this good shit is going to be rocking the balls off your eardrums, I guarantee you. And yes, I know that makes no sense whatsoever, but this is the interview we did for DailyGrindhouse.com with previously stated icon John Carpenter. We went into this interview with kind of a different idea. It would have been really easy to jump into this and hit Carpenter with every single fanboy question we could think of. The Thing, Big Trouble in Little China, They Live, Escape from New York. Those films are such a part of my childhood that it was incredibly tempting to do just that. But instead, we decided to talk to him about where he came from, about the town he grew up in, about the time cinema took root in the very fiber of his being. And through that conversation, we ended up talking abstractly about his films and his career. Carpenter is a really cool cat, and we want to thank him once again for his time. But in the words of Marty DeBerge, enough of my yakking. Without further hint or preview, ladies and bastards, Mr. John Carpenter. Like to start with all our guests talking about the first film that really changed their life, and I know there were a few for you, but I want to go back a little bit further. You moved from Carthage, New York to Bowling Green, Kentucky at the age of 5, which would have been 1953 or so.
That's right.
You stayed there until you went to USC in the late 60s. Talk to us a little bit about growing up in Kentucky.
Well, it was Kentucky was a beautiful state, is a beautiful state, and was a beautiful state then. But we were Northern New York Yankees, my parents and I. And we moved into this little town in the middle of the Bible Belt in the Jim Crow South. So this was absolute culture shock for my parents and I. So probably more my parents, because I didn't know what the hell was going on. You know, I was an idiot then. But it was a mixed bag.
Yeah. Did you feel like an outsider?
Oh, Lord, man. Total outsider. I'll give this town something. Everything I know about evil, I learned in that little town.
Well, how so?
Little thing. In every way you can imagine. The way
really?
People treat each other, the way people treat outsiders, the way the suspicion of the outsider, in every way. Like I said, this was Jim Crow era. There was some pretty outrageous things happening there.
Right. Do you go back to that time frequently when you're writing?
Well, since I haven't written in a long time, I don't have to worry about that. But sure I do. I think about it. I think about the past a bunch. I still go back and see my father. He lives there. He's 92 now. And I think he finally fell in love with Bowling Green. For whatever reason, but you know, it has changed a lot. The South has changed a lot.
Yeah,
it's not the same place it was when I was young. So I have to say that. It's,
sure.
I'm talking about something that happened long ago. You know, Jobs were he was a graduate of Eastman School of Music, and jobs were scarce for him in those days. So this was an opportunity. The other choice he had was Hawaii. Which I do not understand why he didn't.
Yeah, right.
What were we doing in Bowling Green?
Right. But, what did your parents do?
Well, my dad was a music teacher. He was a violinist, and my mom was just a mom. She worked. She worked occasionally, but pretty much a stay home mom.
Yeah. What is that? I assume that's where you got your musical talent from your father.
That's where I got it all.
Yeah.
He mistakenly tried to get me to play the violin when I was a certain age, and that was a horrible mistake for everybody involved. I did not have any natural talent, but I learned a lot about music and musicality, and I've learned a lot from that experience. Never have your father teach you how to play anything. But I went on to learn the piano. I learned the guitar. I played in a band. So I had general musical knowledge, but I grew up with music. See, that's the big thing. I grew up with it, listening to it all the time.
Right.
And all kinds of music, classical music primarily. But my dad was a session musician in Nashville, Tennessee. He's one of the founding members of the Nashville Strings. They played backup for the likes of Roy Orbison and
Ray
Charles and people like that. So I would go with him to recording sessions and just see all these people. It was amazing. But it was but I had a little bit more than just a classical upbringing.
Were you old enough to kind of appreciate who the people that were around you at that time? I mean,
sure, I was really impressed with them. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
So, are you? If we kind of fast forward a little bit, are there things you can express musically that you can't theatrically, or do you look at them as two strictly different mediums?
Well, they're just strictly different.
I don't have anything really that
I want to express that music won't do fine, or movies won't do fine. It all depends on something that's story-driven or whether it's a music. You know, I think probably music is the ultimate art form because it doesn't require words. But I fell in love with movies, so that was my calling.
Yeah. You know, I watched a documentary on Woody Allen the other day, and he was telling a story about one of his friends telling him that he had gone to the movie theater and was shooting spitballs during the picture at the screen, and they were bursting into flames. And you know, the larger story was the idea that theater is really magical to a kid. In fact, I remember as a child thinking there was actually people behind the screen doing a performance, and that's what we
were seeing. Tell me about it, man. Me too.
Theater is this unique experience that you can't really replicate anywhere, and I was wondering if you could kind of tell us a little bit about discovering the theater as a child and what that meant to you.
Well, I had a very similar experience to what you had, which is I think the first movie I ever saw was The African Queen. and that was in 1951 or two. I don't remember now. And I was in the theater. This was in Northern New York, and I remember thinking there were people behind the screen. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a theater show, and they're back there.
Right.
And my father had to explain, no, that's not how it works. And he pointed to the projection booth, and there was this flickering light that was flickering out. He said, that's where they come from. From in there, they're projected on the screen. And I thought, man, that is magical.
Yeah.
Wow, what is that? I've never heard of that before. So that was my first taste of movies. And then I think... My biggest early influence in terms of movies was a film called It Came from Outer Space.
Yeah, Howard Hawks.
And then 1952, that was was in 3D, and it just blew my mind. It was like, my God, what is this? And I think I probably fell in love viscerally with the movies then. That I was so terrified by the opening sequence, mm-hmm. and so riveted by it, and I fell in love with it. I thought, anything that can do this, this is magic. You know,
so,
this is absolute magic.
How do you take that next step then? I mean, you always hear about comedians transcribing sets that they find interesting so they can understand the mechanics of what's happening. You hear about, you know, screenwriters kind of writing down different scenes so they can study how a scene is laid out. What kind of things did you do after seeing that film, or how did that next jump start to take hold?
Well, nothing really happened for a long period of time. I just didn't have any outlet for it there. I think I had an amateur magazine that I published, and I kept going to movies and loving them, but I had my father's 8mm camera, so I made some home movies with my friends, starring my friends. And but that was about all.
Yeah.
Life moved on, and came time I was in college at Western Kentucky University. That's the university that's in Bowling Green. And I was a dead end. There was nothing I wanted there. There's nothing I wanted to do there. I asked my father, and this was in 1968, if I could go out and study film. Because I had read that there was such a thing as a film school, part of a university. I'd never heard of it before. And I looked up, did some research, and there were several of them that taught cinema. And I thought, this was like a dream, really. And there was this guy named George Lucas who had won this big important award for a film he made called THX 1138.
Mm-hmm.
I'm impressed. You know, wow, this is what is this? So my father agreed. He said, okay, you can go. So I packed my bags and came to California. This is where I began my real education.
Right. And you had some pretty impressive lecturers there.
Oh, it was unbelievable.
Orson Welles.
I was there during a great time.
Right.
Because old Hollywood is still alive and was still there. Even if many of the guys had retired, they were still very, very present. But we had Orson Welles and John Ford and Howard Hawks and lesser lights also come and talk to us. Hitchcock was there about their movies and... you know, for me, it was incredible. I remember, we watched some of the films I had seen when I was young, but seeing them a different way, totally different way. A lot of the kids who were there didn't really appreciate the directors that showed up, I didn't think. I thought they kind of took them for granted. I remember the night that Howard Hawks was there, one of the audience members attacked him for making movies with violence in them, which just seemed odd. And then this was the height of the Vietnam War. There was a lot of political stuff going on, a lot of conflict. We had in the Department of Cinema at USC, there was a program to train soldiers, Army, Navy, Air Force, in cinematography, in basically filmmaking. And so we were side by side with military officers who are these great guys. I mean, just really wonderful people. But there was a faction of the student body, these kids my age, who just, you know, hated anything to do with the military. And so there's a lot of conflict, and a lot of, especially when Nixon started bombing Cambodia, the place heated up a lot. But
mm-hmm. So when you had these lecturers coming in, John Ford, Howard Hawks, did you ever have a chance to kind of pull them aside and ask them questions directly?
Well, I asked questions when they were talking in the audience, but I didn't have the guts to pull them aside. Hell no.
Yeah, that had to have been surreal to see Howard Hawks there. After.
Oh yeah, that was big time.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, Orson Welles was equally big time, man.
Yeah, oh, talk about a great storyteller.
But that's what he did. He came in and just told stories. Yeah, he just sat up there and told stories. And he was there. He was making a movie called The Other Side of the Wind, which was I don't think he ever finished it. But he wanted to get questions from a student audience asked of a director. So we were the guinea pigs. He would film us asking questions. During that time, he just told stories. That's who he was.
Yeah.
Big old giant guy.
Right. Did you ever have a chance to meet him after you kind of made a name for yourself?
No, never did.
Okay.
Never did.
You're in a pretty small league of directors who make a very identifiable style of picture. I think, you know a Scorsese, there's a type of storytelling there. And I think you know the same thing with a John Carpenter film. There's just a very distinct way of presenting a picture. Do you know when you kind of found your voice, or when you realized, or if you realized, you know, this is what a Carpenter film looks like?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think I'm still figuring some of that out. I think you never stop learning.
Sure.
When you make a film. But yeah, it was a synthesis of all the things that I fell in love with about cinema and about techniques that I saw that I can borrow, or that's a kind statement, I can steal.
Right.
but sure, I don't remember exactly when that was.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure about that, but I think so, yeah.
Right.
I think there's a distinct... Well, I always thought that most directors had a unique and identifiable style that I could tell after seeing a couple of their movies. Sidney Pollack, he's apparently a guy without a particular style, but I can tell his style by watching his movies, the way he frames them, the way he sees a scene. M. Kubrick and all directors, you can kind of see a personal style to the really good ones. So
yeah,
I developed mine out of, you know, stealing from everybody else.
Right. Have you ever seen The Yakuza?
Yeah.
Speaking of, God, what an amazing movie that is.
I love that movie. Yeah, it's terrific.
Great, great Paul Schrader script. I heard that actually Paul Schrader's brother actually wrote that script. I read that book somewhere. But anyway, yeah, phenomenal, phenomenal movie. You know, I've heard the thing described as an allegory to the AIDS epidemic, Big Trouble in Little China. I've heard people talk about the really discussion on reality. Obviously, They Live has a very heavy message about capitalism attached to it. And I think that means two things. It means that people care about your films a great deal. And two, because of that, they're always looking for something deeper than the basic story. Are you aware of that as a filmmaker when you're looking to make a feature, or are you just looking at what the story is? I mean, is there a bigger picture when you're
all
when
of
you're
it? You're looking at all of it. You're looking at everything.
Yeah,
absolutely. You're looking at a big picture, but you're not. You know, there's no such thing as messages don't work in movies.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing you have to forego is that you can't present a message to people. So they won't. It doesn't work. movies are an emotional medium. They're dramatic medium. People go to lose themselves and project themselves into people on the screen. That's what they want to do. They want to go and see movie stars and romantic stories and scary stories, funny stories. Any filmmaker, anybody, sort of identifies thematic material that he's working with. Mm-hmm. Let me put it to you that way. Not a message or a series of messages, but simply the thematic material of this movie covers X, whatever it is. Okay, so you know that, you're aware of that, and your choice is how far to go in it, you know, how far to delve into that area.
Right.
And that's director's choice, you know. Some people really dive in, and most don't.
Is They Live kind of an example of you really diving into that message? Or?
Well, They Live was its flaws, as far as I'm concerned, was it was too preachy. It was my rage, primal scream at the Reagan Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's I hit it on the head. I should have been more subtle with it. And I had a choice of stories. One was told from the working poor point of view, the one we shot. That's the movie that you see. And there's another one that's from the upper middle class point of view. It's somebody in a TV station. And I chose the working poor idea. But yeah, I mean, it's, as far as I'm concerned, that's a documentary.
Yeah.
That's not, you know, it's still going on.
Right.
The Eddie's never ended, as one of my socialist friends keeps telling me.
Yeah.
Over and over again. They never ended.
Right.
And they're still with us. And that unrestrained capitalism is still, you know, carrying us along in its embrace.
Well, I would say not only has it not ended, I think people have doubled down on it. If you look at the Tea Party and things like that, I mean, it's almost gotten worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want to know something about something funny about They Live? I saw that, gosh, I don't know, I probably – early 90s, I worked at a video store for a long time, and I'm up in Portland, Oregon.
Uh-huh.
And a suburb of Portland. And so I watched the movie, and a week later, guy comes in to rent Blackbeard's Ghost, and it's Roddy Piper.
Yeah, right.
God damn, that was one of the most surreal things that ever happened to me. I just watched the movie, and here he is renting Blackbeard's Ghost right in front of me.
Yeah, he lives up there. Yeah.
He does. Yeah, he actually lives about a mile from my house.
There you go.
Yeah, he's always I see him pretty often, actually. You know, there have been a number of your films that have done or I should say that haven't done particularly well at the box office, but have gone on to mean a great deal to a large number of people. Do you ever feel like your films always get a second look if they don't make that initial hit at the box office? I mean, do you think you kind of have I don't want to say a safety net, but it seems your films get a second at bat on most occasions.
Well, some occasions they do. I don't play for the box office necessarily. I play for the horizon.
Right.
What I mean by that is I play for a longer game. I play for something that's going to last. You know, if you strip away the costumes, some of the costumes and mannerisms and acting styles, it's something that hopefully will last. So,
mm-hmm.
But I don't care about the box office. I mean, everybody wants to be loved and wants a hit.
Sure.
Be king of shit, you know, everybody.
Yeah.
So it's not nice when they call you names, but I've gotten used to it over the years.
Well, I mean, geez, the films of yours, I mean, it seems like nearly every film that you've made has this a fan base behind it. I mean, there's very few of yours that aren't considered classics. I mean, that has to make you feel good as a director. And
you know what? I'm 64. I'm going to be 65 next year. I'm eligible to retire. That makes me very happy.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, I've had a great career. I just can't believe I've had the career I've had. It was my dream as a kid. I wanted to be a professional movie director.
Yeah.
And I got to live out my dream. And when I see how many people are not able to,
right.
It's shocking.
Your early films feature characters that are geographically trapped. But as you move along in your filmography, you start to see that you really move from geographically trapped or isolated to kind of mentally or psychologically. I mean, look, if you look at In the Mouth of Madness or The Ward, you really see that progression.
I see what you mean. That's interesting. That's really an interesting comment. I hadn't thought of it that way before.
Yeah, is there a parallel there?
Well, sure. You know, one is a stand-in. I mean, the geographical is a stand-in for the emotional, but after a while, it's you just got to go for the emotional. Sure. It's especially with my last film, that was a real internal landscape movie type film.
Another thing, a reoccurring theme with your films is antiheroes populate the landscape. And there's some exceptions, but what is it about the kind of the loner that you dig so much? What is it about writing that type of character that you enjoy?
Well, I can identify with that person because that's who I am. That's me.
Yeah.
I'm not a hero of any kind, but I identify with that kind of a person, with a loner, somebody who's isolated in certain ways.
Right.
So that's just who I know, those people, because I am one.
Yeah. You know, well, I guess on the flip side of that, we were talking to Larry Cohen yesterday. I don't know if you know.
I know Larry.
Yeah, we were doing a story. They're going back to the Maniac Cop franchise and doing kind of a prequel with Nick Winding Refn producing. And he said that there was an old rule in the business that the better the villain, the better the film. And if that's to be believed, you got it made because you've made some iconic villains. I mean, talk to us about writing that type of character. Is it easier to write a villain than a loner, an antihero, or is it just another part of the story?
It's another part of the story. It's another part of me. I mean, it's us, we. It's another part of humanity.
Right.
But villains are fun to write, and you just have to figure out why they are doing what they're doing.
Right.
And it's what is in it for them? Why are they so pissed off?
You know, when I watch films with my buddies, we always start talking inevitably about who are, what type of films our favorite directors should make or what we would love to see them do. And with you, for instance, we always come back to the Western idea, seeing you do a True Blood Western. But was there ever a film you wanted a Howard Hawks or Fred Wilcox or John Ford to explore, or a genre you wanted to see them get into that they didn't?
I wish Hawks had done a more explicit spooky movie, as I think he originally had. His reputation originally was of a director of really terrifying scenes.
Right.
Unlike Westerns. That changed with Red River. But he was known for kind of scary moments in films. A lot of his aviation films have really tension-filled sequences.
Mm-hmm.
Only Angels Have Wings does. He had a movie he was trying to set up called Dreadful Hollow. It was a treatment by, I can't remember who it was, but I would love to have seen him done that.
Are there genres you yourself want to explore? Do you want to do a Western?
Oh, hell yes. But, yeah. I don't know. There's no more stars.
Right.
Eastwood quit and Wayne's gone. And
what about Kurt Russell's
know, but
Western?
Well, sure. It'd be great. He's doing one with, what's his name now?
Yeah, Tarantino.
Young Genius.
Young Genius. Yeah. You know, in the world of world of stage production, you know, writers are God, but they're in the world of films, it's more of outline than gospel. Do you still encounter that as somebody who kind of works on both sides, even though you haven't written for a while? But do you have a problem when somebody takes your work and kind of scraps it and rewrites it and plays around with the words that you've written on the page?
Well, no, that's part of the movie business. I mean, it doesn't bother me. Of course,
yeah.
I can't understand why they don't see the brilliance that I did, but it's the director's medium.
Yeah.
As a writer, when I wrote The Eyes of Laura Mars, and they changed it. They did and they didn't change it. They changed a lot of things about it, but that's fine. I didn't direct it. Not my movie.
Right.
So I have no complaints. As long as I get a check, if they pay me.
You know, Melville Shavelson said, a writer by choice, producer by necessity, director for self-defense. And you kind of employ all those areas. How do you navigate each of those and show the discipline to the responsibility of those categories all at the same time? Do you like managing all those different aspects of a project because you have more control, or is it just more of a kind of a natural fit for the project when you do that?
Well, let me make one thing very clear to you, is that I don't like to work. I would much rather not work. If I could find a profession of some kind that paid me money for doing nothing, I would be in heaven.
Yeah.
That's what I'd want to find. But after a while, you know, when you're directing, from film school on, you have to do everything. You have to know everything. You have to know editing and sound and acting and writing and lab processing and all of it, everything.
Yeah.
Photography. You have to know everything to be a good director, or else you're disarmed.
Right.
You have to know the lenses and the camera. Nobody in film school wanted to learn them. And you got to go memorize the American Cinematographer Manual. And then you just spend a weekend doing that, and then you have it.
Right.
You got to know everything. So when you direct, when you start getting involved, Melville Shavelson, thank you, is right. But that's just something that you have to know.
Yeah.
It's a requirement. It's a requirement. Well, you got to know everything so you can answer every question. That's the whole secret of directing. Is no matter what anybody asks, you have an answer.
Yeah.
Answer it. Do this. Now, you can change your mind later on. But the worst thing you can do is say, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, fuck, you're dead. And whoever's asking you, what do? I make this green or blue? Just answer them. Then think about it later. You can figure it out. Or maybe that was a stupid thing to say. And just say, though, you know, I've changed my mind. I want it to be this. But not being decisive, well, that's not directing.
Yeah.
Decide.
Hey, I was reading, we were just speaking about Tarantino, but on Django Unchained the other day, I saw that...
What's the name of it again?
Django Unchained.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Yeah.
I bet it's going to be great. I bet it's great.
I'm sure it's going to be okay. Although, which brings me back, I wasn't a fan of Death Proof. I didn't.
Oy.
Did you not dig that either?
I haven't been a fan in a while, but I'm a member of the minority because everybody's, I haven't been a fan for quite a while on his stuff.
Yeah,
it's always good, boy. He's always good. He's always got some stuff going. But that Nazi movie was woof. But I was completely wrong about it. See, that's why you should never hire me for anything, because I don't know anything.
Right. but I was reading on that film that Lawrence Bender wasn't producing, and it's only the second time that's happened in their career together. And just it made me think about your relationship with your wife and with the late Deborah Hill.
Mm-hmm.
What is that kind of deep relationship do for a film when you don't have that director working or that you don't have that producer working with you that you have such a deep commitment to?
Great to have that. My wife and I are one big example of we just love working together. But and Deborah, yes, for a few times. But the guy who I worked with many years, 10 years or more, who did more of my films than anybody else, is Larry Franco, is his name.
Yeah.
He went on to be a big-time producer. But we had an amazing... He was an amazing relationship. He was an AD. And he really had the ability to get people to do almost anything. And I really loved him. He was great. We had a great run together. So I have to give him props.
Outside of it being your livelihood, what does film mean to you?
Passion.
Yeah.
It's all about passion. and love. I fell in love with cinema when I was little, and I was told myself that the time would come when the love stopped and it ended, when the flame died, and said, you got to get out.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. That's what it's only about, is love.
So what'd I tell you? Is that guy cool or what? We're all out of time for this week's episode. Thanks again to John Carpenter for hanging out with us. Don't forget to check out dailygrindhouse.com 3, 4, 5 times a day. Don't miss a thing. Like our Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter at Daily Grindhouse. And on the next show, Brian Trenchard-Smith joins us. It's a long interview. He drops a lot of good stuff. Don't forget to check it out. In the meantime, thanks for hanging out with us. Here's to good watching. Salut.